Our recent studies of Esther came about in preparation originally from a Portland area study weekend that we had a couple years ago. And it was such a fascinating and enjoyable study, I felt I should dig deeper and revisit the topic a bit more in depth. Along the way, I came across talks by a number of brethren that we all know and love. And so I did something that is not uncommon in the teaching world, which is you find something that works well and you borrow a little bit of this and that. And so if you listen, and I recommend you do listen to the available recordings of brothers Joe Miguez and David Rice and Carl Hagensick, you'll no doubt recognize a few points from each that I borrowed, because I think they found some really wonderful grains of truth in there. So we hope that you find something in here to spark your interest in a wonderful story from the Old Testament. So first, let's begin by positioning the book of Esther in its historical context. Israel entered into captivity with Babylon between the years of 605 and 582 BC. There were several rounds of exiles throughout Nebuchadnezzar's reign. And then later, 50 years, give or take a little bit, with the fall of Babylon in 539 BC to Cyrus the Great of Persia, the Jews were allowed to begin returning to their homeland. And Cyrus has a special place in the history of the Jewish people, thanks to his remarkable tolerance of varied religious beliefs and cultural traditions. Now, here we encounter some historical questions about how to best reconcile the biblical account with the secular history that we understand. It's unclear if the Darius of Daniel and the lion's den is actually Cyrus, or if it's someone appointed by Cyrus, or maybe even Cyrus's father-in-law. There are some varying opinions. But regardless, after the reign of Cyrus, we have the reigns of Cambyses, his son, and Bardia briefly, and then Darius the First, who is assumed to have come along too late to be the Darius from Daniel. And then there's the son of Darius the First, Xerxes. And we know him also by another name, Ahasuerus, from the story of Esther. So therefore, in a relatively short span of years, and this is what I found fascinating, we have the tales of Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego under Nebuchadnezzar, followed not long later by Daniel and those lions. And then maybe 60, 70, 80 years later comes the story of Esther. And many of the Jews that had been in captivity to Babylon were allowed to go home, but many stayed due either to the fact that it's convenient and easy to stay, or an increased degree of religious tolerance, perhaps. And so we ask, why was this story of Esther preserved for us? It's a very wonderful story, and in fact, neither Shakespeare nor Hollywood could have done a better job of adding in danger and plot twists and excitement. Now, of course, this is also an important event in the history of the Jews, as it is what leads to their Feast of Purim. And on top of this, we have some wonderful character lessons for ourselves. We read in Esther 1, verses 1 through 4. Now, it took place in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants, the army officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. Now, the Medo-Persian Empire was huge. It ranged from India on the east all the way to Ethiopia on the west. And Ahasuerus gave a banquet for all his princes and attendants over a period of 6 months. It has been suggested this wouldn't have been practical for all to have attended at the same time. So maybe there was a rotating group of attendants in order to allow the general running of the empire to continue without some kind of 6-month-long nationwide interruption. It's further been suggested that the purpose of this banquet may have been to discuss the king's desire to conquer Greece. It was not to be, but Greece had previously repelled the takeover attempt by his father. History tells us that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, would also fail at this attempt. But in this account of his banquet, we learn something else important about the king. we learn he has a great deal of pride and self-satisfaction in his office. As with many kings, he felt the need to ostentatiously show off his great wealth for everyone to see. And of course, we also will find that he's rather easily led by his advisors. After this extensive feast, he holds a smaller feast for all those present in his winter palace of Susa, which you may also see known as Shushan. It's a 7-day feast, including the royal wine, at the end of which we read, again, Esther, the first chapter, now verses 10 through 12. On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded the 7 eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. Then the king became very angry, and his wrath burned within him. And you may recall how this plays out. The king's advisors tell him this cannot be tolerated. After all, if women start to disobey their husbands, who knows what kind of anarchy will occur? And so Vashti was permanently banished from the king's presence. And so we want to note here that the king is quick to wrath. This is an important point to keep in mind as we read through this story. And then in Esther 2 verse 1, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. It turns out the king was likely absent from Persia for parts of 2 years during his assault on Greece. And upon returning home, you can imagine what happened. He had previously flown into a rage and said things he regretted, which is a very human thing to do. But apparently it's even more so a very Persian king thing to do. And it's bad enough when any of us say things we regret to our spouse, but imagine when you're the king of the Medes and the Persians and you can make irrevocable decisions. So now he's returned to his home and he's cooled off and he misses his wife, but there's nothing he can do about it. She's banished. Now, I hardly think that the point of this book is primarily about the temper of Ahasuerus, but I find the control of one's temper and the ability to repent of that temper to be an important part of the story and worth at least pointing out. And at the same time, we want to look at Vashti. She chose an interesting course of action. It's very easy for us to judge her actions in hindsight, of course, but surely she knew the temper of Ahasuerus and must have suspected this was not going to go well. Moreover, the king was drunk with wine, and I cannot imagine he was making a reasonable request, and I don't blame her for not wishing to display herself for her drunken husband and his princes. But Brother Russell makes a very interesting point in reprint 4900. We read, many will say that she did just right in asserting her womanhood and standing up for her rights, etc. We will not dispute that all women have rights and that Queen Vashti had hers and she exercised them. We merely offer the suggestion that in a question of your rights, along lines of force and compulsion, Queen Vashti won a victory which cost her dearly. In Queen Esther's procedure, which is the subject of this lesson, we see the opposite course pursued. The queen won a great victory with happy results by a totally different procedure, and one which, in our judgment, recommends itself to the wisest and best of men and women. Vashti could have taken a similar course, but did not. However much she might have felt the king's requirement of her presence would expose her to jest or rudeness, she should have relied upon her charm and tact and purity and upon her husband's love and care. Now, I don't want to belabor this point, as I wouldn't claim, again, it's the main intent, but it's always wise to consider our actions and the repercussions. Something that I've said numerous times as both a parent and a teacher is that when you're dealing with a superior, whether that be an adult or a manager or a teacher, it is nearly always, except in extreme circumstances, it's nearly always better to obey at first and then afterwards ask your questions. Perhaps things might have gone a lot better for Vashti had she considered this. Now, of course, we all know that it worked out exactly as the Lord intended. And now we come to the portion of the story where Vashti is replaced. With the king missing his wife, his advisors once again intervened. It would seem they're very persuasive. And we read in Esther 2, verses 2 to 4. Then the king's personal attendants suggested, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king. Let the king appoint emissaries in all the provinces of his realm to gather all beautiful young virgins into the harem in the royal precinct of Susa. Under the care of the royal eunuch Higai, guardian of the women, let cosmetics be given them. Then the young woman who pleases the king shall reign in place of Vashti. This suggestion pleased the king, and he acted accordingly. And here is where Esther enters the picture. She is living with her cousin Mordecai, as she no longer had a father or mother. According to Jewish tradition, Mordecai was a member of the Sanhedrin, and as such was well educated in the law and in languages. One source suggests the knowledge of up to 70 tongues. Not sure that's true, but if it is, it may also play a part in this story. And if Mordecai was such a member, it is likely that Esther was raised in a very pious household and would have been well educated in the Jewish laws and customs. When the many young ladies were gathered to Susa in the custody of Higai, Esther apparently made a favorable impression, as we read in 2:9. The young woman pleased him and won his favor, so he promptly furnished her with the cosmetics and provisions. Then, choosing 7 maids for her from the royal palace, he transferred both her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Perhaps we already see the hand of the Lord working here. Esther is quickly set up as a favorite for the king's affection. Based on the way things were done at the time, it's possible that Esther was only 15 years old when she was taken to Susa. Can you imagine the challenge for her to cope with being separated from her only family at such a young age? And on top of this, Mordecai instructed her to keep her heritage a secret. It is not clear what motivated this decision. Perhaps there was some sort of persecution going on at this time, or perhaps he was simply moved by the Holy Spirit. Whatever the case, she was successful in hiding her origins. And this too is important to the story. Next, the young women gathered into Ahasuerus' harem underwent a full year of beauty treatments. A full year. Think about that. That's like a day spa times 365. We read in chapter 2, verses 12 through 16. After the 12 months preparation decreed for the women, each one went in turn to visit King Ahasuerus. During this period of beautifying treatment, 6 months were spent with oil of myrrh and the other 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. Then, when each one was to visit the king, she was allowed to take with her from the harem to the royal palace whatever she chose. She would go in the evening, return in the morning to a second harem under the care of the royal eunuch, Shashgaz, guardian of the concubines. She could not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and had her summoned by name. As for Esther, daughter of Abihail and adopted daughter of his nephew Mordecai, when her turn came to visit the king, she did not ask for anything but what the royal eunuch Higai, guardian of the women, suggested. And she won the admiration of all who saw her. Esther was led to King Ahasuerus in his palace in the 10th month, Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. There are 2 points of interest here. First, in what manner did Esther approach the king, and how did she come to this decision? To begin with, imagine what a 15-year-old girl must be feeling at a time like this. On the one hand, she's undoubtedly nervous and uncertain, but then it's probably not an uncommon age to be married at that time, with rather short lifespans, and perhaps maybe there's some excitement for to become a queen is really a prestigious thing. And I would further imagine that there would be some contention amongst the contenders for the king's attentions. So picture in your mind a large group of possibly teenage girls all trying to gain the attention of the king. When offered her choice of anything from the harem, each would certainly have tried to outdo the other with jewelry and perfume and makeup. And now it's Esther's turn. And she asks the advice humbly of Higai, who's in charge of the concubines, and his advice is, go clothed with your natural beauty. Take nothing extra. And so armed with her beauty and her youth and avoiding the distractions of excessive makeup and jewelry, is it any wonder that she stood out from the crowd? We would suspect that Higai knew exactly what he was doing. So what are some lessons for us in this example of Esther? Well, certainly to ask for guidance. To admit that we don't have all the answers is a good start. as we read in Proverbs 3:7, do not be wise in your own eyes. And furthermore, Esther's unadorned and simple beauty is a wonderful picture of the simple beauty of our faith. Our faith needs no additions or subtractions. It needs nothing extra, perfume or makeup to hide any imperfections of its own. It stands on its own as exceptional. And when it's compared with all the others, it stands well above the rest. Continuing with our story, after Esther becomes queen in the 7th year of the reign of Ahasuerus, mentioned just a moment ago in Esther 2:17, we're told that Mordecai is sitting at the king's gate. Since the king's gate was the seat of day-to-day government, it can be inferred that Mordecai held some sort of position in the political structure at the time. His positioning here was another example of God's providence, as we see in Esther 2, verses 21 to 23. During the time that Mordecai spent at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the royal eunuchs who guarded the entrance, became angry and plotted to assassinate King Ahasuerus. When the plot became known to Mordecai, he told Queen Esther, who in turn informed the king in Mordecai's name. The matter was investigated and verified, and both of them were impaled on stakes. And this was written in the annals in the king's presence. There is some speculation about how would Mordecai have become privy to the plotting of two of the king's eunuchs. Some suggest they wouldn't have discussed the plot openly. Others suggest that maybe they conversed in their native language, a foreign language, believing themselves to be safe in this manner from prying ears. And perhaps Mordecai's supposed mastery of very many languages may have played a role. That's a Jewish tradition. Regardless, somehow he was able to convey this knowledge to the king through Esther. Perhaps most noteworthy in this instance is that all Mordecai got for his trouble was an annotation in the annals of the king. He saved the king's life, and his reward was barely a word of thanks. We'll make note of it. Now, that might make some men bitter, but we have no record of any such reaction from Mordecai. And while it might only be a small lesson, I like this idea that when we do good to others, it should be with no thought to a reward for ourselves and no expectation of even a thank you. Do we ever feel we deserve recognition, or are we satisfied in ourselves? The next time you catch yourself feeling frustrated because of a lack of recognition, remember, the Lord sees it, and that's all that's really important. And returning to our story, we'll soon find that being written in the annals is not the same as being written off. The next stage in this story is where the tension really picks up. A number of years after his marriage to Esther, Ahasuerus promotes Haman the Agagite and places him in authority of all the princes who were with him. We aren't told more than that about just where Haman came from or how he rose through the ranks, but this illustrates yet again that Ahasuerus seems blind to the liabilities of his best advisors. And Haman has liabilities just like all the others. The first action we're told of regarding Haman is that the king commanded all to bow down and pay homage to him. And this is in Esther 3, verses 1 through 6. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, to high rank, seating him above all his fellow officials. All the king's servants who were at the royal gate would kneel and bow down to Haman, for that is what the king had ordered in his regard. Mordecai, however, would not kneel and bow down. The king's servants who were at the royal gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you disobey the king's order?" When they had reminded him day after day and he would not listen to them, they informed Haman to see whether Mordecai's explanation would prevail, since he had told them that he was a Jew. That apparently was his explanation. When Haman observed that Mordecai would not kneel and bow down to him, he was filled with anger. But he thought it was beneath him to attack only Mordecai. Since they had told Haman of Mordecai's nationality, he sought to destroy all the Jews, Mordecai's people, throughout the realm of King Ahasuerus. This is a great passage for several reasons. To start with, just why would the king have to command everybody to bow down to Haman? Is suggested that if Haman were truly a worthy prince, all would of course bow down to him. But perhaps instead, he was one of those who needs that attention, but deserves very little. And so he maneuvered and suggested and prodded the king to issue such a decree in order to feed his ego. And on top of this, Mordecai would not bow down to Haman. That's a peculiar action in that he must certainly expect it to bring about repercussions. But I think the answer to this and to Haman's excessive response might lie in the ancestry of both Mordecai and Haman. It turns out their bloodlines had been set against each other for many generations, from approximately 200 years previous. If we return to Esther 2, verse 5, we read, "There was in the royal precinct of Susa a certain Jew named Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite." And let us compare 1 Samuel 9:1 and then 1 Samuel 14:51. There was a powerful man from Benjamin named Kish, who was the son of Abiel, son of Zeror, son of Becherath, son of Aphia, a Benjaminite. And then in 1 Samuel 14:51, Kish was the father of Saul. Now, it's true, Kish is likely not a unique name, but there is a possibility that Mordecai is from the same bloodline as Saul. Perhaps a great-great-great-great nephew of some sort. Furthermore, if we pay attention to Haman the Agagite, we compare 1 Samuel 15, verses 1 to 3, 7 to 9, and then 32 and 33. Samuel said to Saul, "It was I the Lord sent to anoint you king over his people, Israel. Now therefore listen to the message of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish what Amalek did to the Israelites, when he barred their way as they came up from Egypt. Go now attack Amalek and put under the ban everything he has. Do not spare him. Kill men and women, children and infants, oxen and sheep, camels and donkeys." Then skipping to verse 7, after the Kenites left, Saul routed Amalek from Havilah to the approaches of Shur on the frontier of Egypt. He took Agag, this is the key, Agag, king of Amalek, alive. But the rest of the people he destroyed by the sword, putting them under the ban. He and his troops spared Agag and the best of the fat sheep and oxen and the lambs. They refused to put under the ban anything that was worthwhile, destroying only what was worthless and of no account. Afterwards, Samuel commanded, "Bring Agag, king of Amalek, to me." Agag came to him struggling and saying, "So it is bitter death." And Samuel said, "As your sword has made women childless, so shall your mother be childless among women." And then he cut Agag to pieces before the Lord in Gilgal. So we know that Haman was an Agagite, which would imply a descent there. So imagine you're Mordecai and Haman. Your ancestors, perhaps Saul and Agag, are bitter enemies. Your great-great-great uncle is responsible for destroying the nation and rulership of his great-great-great grandfather. And the fact that your great-great-great-great-uncle foolishly showed mercy to his great-great-great-grandfather cost him his kingdom. So as Mordecai, are you going to bow down to this man who should not even be alive today? And when they asked him why he wouldn't bow down, his reply was that he was a Jew, which seems almost a strange response, unless maybe it was a sort of taunt or message from Mordecai. They then took this response to Haman. "Hey, this guy over there won't bow down to you because he says he's a Jew." What's Haman's reaction going to be? Perhaps if he's a descendant of Agag, he'll be even angrier than before. It's not just that he's not bowing down. It's that he's not bowing down and he's sort of throwing in my face this past animosity. And so it makes sense that Haman's wrath would burn against Mordecai's entire people. Which leads us to the general lesson here, which is that obedience is better than sacrifice. If Saul, way back when, had taken care of business as he was directed, Haman wouldn't even be in the picture to cause this distress amongst the Jews in Persia. The Lord's purposes are so much deeper and interconnected than any of us can truly fathom, and it is why obedience always is the best course of action, even while understanding is still developing. And at which point we remind you of this idea that we should obey first and ask questions later. Now, whether or not these are his true motivations, Haman does make it his mission in life to wipe out not only Mordecai, but all of the Jews. We read in Esther 3, verses 7 through 11. "In the first month, Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, the Pur, or Lot, was cast in Haman's presence to determine the day and month for the destruction of Mordecai's people on a single day. And the lot fell on the 13th day of the 12th month, Adar. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, dispersed among the nations throughout the provinces of your kingdom, there is a certain people living apart. Their laws differ from those of every other people, and they do not obey the laws of the king, so it is not proper for the king to tolerate them. If it please the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will deliver to the procurators 10,000 silver talents for deposit in the royal treasury. In other words, you kill them and I'll pay you for it. The king took the signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, the silver is yours, as well as the people, to do with as you please. Thus, in his position of confidence to Ahasuerus, he is easily able to gain his ear, make a vague proposition. No, he doesn't even mention the Jews by name, but simply describes a threat to the laws of the empire and manages to bribe his way into getting this edict passed. By one estimate, 10,000 talents of silver is 2/3 of the annual revenue of the entire Medo-Persian empire. Note that Haman believes in fortune-telling as he casts lots to determine the best day on which to carry out an attack on the Jews, which thankfully for the Jews was approximately a year away. That pur, or lot, by the way, mentioned above in plural is Purim, and that's the origin of the Jewish feast of Purim, which is their way of remembering the Lord's deliverance via Esther. And as the decree goes out across the land, Mordecai learns of it and quickly lets Esther know, as she is certainly the best hope for the Jews at this point. So let us once again put ourselves in Esther's shoes. We've had 5 years to grow accustomed to life as queen, but surely we don't get to see our family anymore. Perhaps 20 years old now, we're faced with a crisis of greater scope than simply being forced to marry the king. Now, our life and the lives of our entire people depend on us. And it's already been decreed by an edict of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be altered. So what do you do? This sounds like a job for a Saul or a David or a Gideon, not a 20-year-old girl. But Mordecai sends a message to Esther via her servant, ordering her to go to the king and plead for their people. And Esther replies to Mordecai in Esther 4:11, all the servants of the king and people of his provinces know that any man or woman who goes to the king in the inner court without being summoned is subject to the same law, death. Only if the king extends the golden scepter will such a person live. Now, as for me, I have not been summoned to the king for 30 days. So essentially, her response is, I can't do that. He could kill me. And he hasn't called me in 30 days, so maybe he's growing tired of me. From what we've read about the king, to find him fickle would not be a surprise. And while I think we all understand the basic concept that it must have been dangerous to approach the king unsummoned, I suspect that you, as I did, might not truly have a sense of the great possible danger. After all, it's his wife. Would he really kill her just because she didn't wait to be called? And so we go to reprint 3656, where Brother Russell shares a story of the wrath of Xerxes, who we understand to be Ahasuerus. The queen's answer was that Mordecai, as well as all the people, knew that if she or anyone else should attempt to go into the king's presence uninvited, it would mean their death, unless he chanced to feel favorable to them and extend his golden scepter. I'm going to skip down a little bit. For instance, her fears were not groundless in the event to those acquainted with the history of those times. For instance, it's recorded of this very same king that when en route for a war, he rested at Olene of Phrygia, where he was the guest of a Pythias, who entertained him magnificently. But when the latter begged as a favor that of his 5 sons in the king's army, the eldest might be left with him in his old age, the brutal Xerxes, in a rage, caused that son to be slain in the presence of his father, the body divided into 2 parts, the one part placed on one side of the road, the other on the other side, and the whole army marched between them. Now, we've already seen the wrath of Ahasuerus on a previous occasion, so this serves to still further convince us he was an unpredictable man. So can we blame a 20-year-old girl for hesitating to approach him? And yet Mordecai has the perfect response, Esther chapter 4, verses 13 to 17. He had this reply brought to her. Do not imagine that you are safe in the king's palace, you alone of all the Jews. Even if you now remain silent, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another source, but you and your father's house will perish. Who knows? Perhaps it was for a time like this that you became queen. Esther sent back to Mordecai the response, go and assemble all the Jews who are in Susa. Fast on my behalf, all of you, not eating or drinking night or day for 3 days. I and my maids will also fast in the same way. Thus prepared, I will go to the king, contrary to the law. If I perish, I perish. Mordecai went away and did exactly as Esther had commanded. I love both of these responses. First of all, Mordecai points out that an opportunity like this must be seized, and Esther must assume she has been placed in this position precisely as the means to the Jews' salvation. Furthermore, if she doesn't take advantage of this opportunity provided for her, she is still not likely to survive the persecution, and moreover, deliverance may be provided from yet another source and leave her and her father's house to perish. And so after prayer and consideration, she realizes her only real option is to proceed with petitioning the king. And in my mind's eye, I can picture this 20-year-old queen steeling herself to risk her life for her people, gathering her resolve and telling Mordecai, if I perish, I perish. I would say this is the largest and most obvious lesson of Esther, that we must be aware of every opportunity to serve the Lord. Who is to say if we haven't been placed into some specific situation exactly because he wants us there to do his will? And certainly we see the Lord's hand in positioning Esther exactly where she needed to be to save the Jews. During one of our studies on this topic, Brother Bruni Hack made a wonderful analogy, and I'll do my best to paraphrase. He said, some of us can be likened to dinner plates, getting lots of daily use in the Lord's service, while others are like a gravy dish, the one that comes out only a few times a year. That doesn't make the gravy dish less important. In fact, in some sense, it's more important because it has that special use for which no other can be substituted. And I just thought that was a wonderful thought. And Brother Russell addresses this nicely in reprint 3657. There's a beautiful lesson of faith here that should appeal to all of the spiritual Israelites. Whatever we have, whatever positions we occupy of influence or power or wealth or confidence in the esteem of others, is so much of a stewardship granted to us by the Lord, and respecting which we should expect to give an account. And if the account would be rendered with joy, we must be faithful even to the risking of our lives in the interest of the Lord's people, the Lord's cause. Let us lay this feature of Esther's experience to heart, that we may draw valuable lessons therefrom, helpful to us in the spiritual way. The suggestion that she had not come to a place of honor and privilege by accident, but that the Lord had overruled in the matter, is one that should appeal to all Israelites indeed. Whatever we have is of the Lord's providence. Let us use it faithfully and as wisely as possible for him and his. Thus our own blessings and joys will be increased, as well as our favor with the Lord. And what a beautiful picture for us of the way in which we should approach our difficult decisions. As Esther implored her people to pray and fast for her, it is also a good practice for us to consider when faced with difficult decisions today. And it doesn't need to be fasting in the sense of avoiding all food. Perhaps instead fasting from worldly distractions. Perhaps eating a limited diet to give your mind clarity. Perhaps prayer and focused meditation can bring us more into harmony with our Father and leave us more receptive to the leading of the Holy Spirit. And so now we turn to Esther, the fifth chapter, and her approach to the king. So it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance to the palace. When the king saw Esther, the queen, standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter, which was in his hand. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. Then the king said to her, what is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom it shall be given to you. Esther said, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I have prepared for him. Then the king said, bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires. So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared. As they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, What is your petition? For it shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. So she replied, and I'll paraphrase a little here. If I found favor in the sight of the king, come to another banquet tomorrow, and then I'll do as the king says. And Haman went out glad and pleased of heart. But when he saw Mordecai in the king's gate, and he didn't stand up or tremble before him, he was again filled with anger against Mordecai. But he controlled himself and went to his house and sent for his friends, his wife. And he recounted to them the glory of his riches and the numbers of his sons and all the glory in which the king had magnified him. And he said, even Esther, let no one but me and the king come to dine with her. And yet this man is not bowing down to me. And so in verse 14, Zeresh's wife and all his friends said to him, have a gallows 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. And then you can go joyfully with the king to the banquet. And so he did so. Now, it's hard to determine just why Esther chooses to host one banquet followed by another. We can speculate, perhaps it's simply to pique the interest of the king. We can assume that his advisors generally waste no time in making their wishes known. And so maybe most who have the king's ear attempt immediately to use this for their own ends. And by taking it slow and making the king wonder, she maybe succeeded in winning him more firmly to her side without even saying anything. Perhaps this is also why he couldn't stop her, rather, he couldn't sleep the following night, as we read in Esther 6, verses 1 to 3. During that night, the king could not sleep, so he gave an order to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. I love this. I can't sleep. Read me the book of records. That'll put me to sleep. It was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? Then the king's servants who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. So the timing of this is amazing. Right as Haman is about to go after Mordecai, the king recognizes he wants to honor Mordecai. And we see that Mordecai's thanks wasn't immediate, but it was yet to come. And so in this next passage, we already can see the events conspiring to bring Haman down. This is where the story just feels so amazing. Feeling that he should reward such loyalty in one of his people, he grabs his nearest advisor, Esther 6, verses 6 to 12, just happens to be Haman. And he says, Haman, what should I do for the man who the king desires to honor? And so Haman, in his pride, thinks it's him that is being spoken of. And Haman says, you should bring a royal robe, which the king has worn, and the horse on which the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble princes. And he tells all these wonderful things that should happen to this man, imagining this is what I want the king to do for me. And so it's such sweet justice when the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horses you have said and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city square and proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. Imagine the emotional whiplash that Haman would be going through at a time like this. Only the day before, he's bragging to his wife and friends about the honor of being invited to dine with the king and queen. And in his pride and malice, he constructed a gallows on which to hang Mordecai. And in fact, that was why he was there in the palace that morning, to discuss hanging Mordecai with the king. And suddenly, his world is turned upside down. He can't hang Mordecai, not now that he's paraded him around the city proclaiming his honor. And surely the king will not soon forget the favor done him by Mordecai. And while he's sharing this unsettling news with his wife and friends, he's summoned to the second banquet. Okay, well, at least something is going right. After the bad day he's having, he can at least comfort himself that he'll share in the privilege of dining with the king and queen. But little could he know that this was about to get worse. A second time they dine, and now the king asks Esther what she wishes of him. And in Esther verses 3 to 6, Queen Esther replies, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, And if it pleases the king, let my life be given as my petition and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed and annihilated. Now, if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with annoying the king. Then King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus? And Esther says, a foe and an enemy is this wicked Haman. And then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. And as we've already mentioned, the king's wrath burns quickly and strongly. And the king arose in anger and went to the palace garden. And Haman threw himself at Esther's feet, and in verses 7 to 10, and he's begging for his life. And when the king returns, it looks like Haman's assaulting the queen. And so he immediately calls for them to cover Haman's face. And one of the eunuchs who were before the king says, behold, there's a gallows standing at his house 50 cubits high, which he made for Mordecai. And the king said, well, you should hang him on it. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai. And the king's anger subsided. I know we're short on time. I'll try to wrap up very briefly here. We can only imagine how desperate Haman would have become. And it's interesting to note in verse 9 that one of the king's eunuchs knew all about the gallows in front of Haman's house and the intent to use them against Mordecai. But our story, while finished for Haman, is not quite resolved for the Jews. There's still the matter of the edict commanding their death. And Esther falls weeping at the feet of Ahasuerus, begging him to save her people and revoke the edict, which I think is interesting because I think we know that he can't. And certainly he explains this to her. However, the house of Haman is given to Mordecai, and one would assume his privileged position as well. The king hands over his signet ring, allowing the drafting of another decree. And this is where the wisdom of Mordecai and the leading of the Spirit really shines through. We can't revoke the decree, but instead permission is granted for the Jews to defend themselves against all who come against them. Who wants to deal with that? And so on that same day that was to be the day of their destruction, instead, they killed at least 800 men in Susa alone who hated the Jews. The 10 sons of Haman were hanged. And apparently throughout the empire, they killed 75,000 who hated the Jews. But they did not take the spoil. And that's a last piece of information that's interesting to note. Why would it matter if they took the spoil? Could it be that many of these were descendants of Agag, as previously mentioned, and just like they ought not to have taken the spoil back in the days of Saul, they did not take the spoil now. And so it came that on the 14th and 15th days they rested, and these days became the celebration of Lots, known as Purim. For Haman had cast Purim to select the day of their destruction. And so this last lesson, which is rather evident but bears emphasizing, is that the Lord can turn defeat into victory through means we cannot guess. And this should be a comfort and encouragement to us through times of trial, for we don't truly need to see a way out if he's with us. Combining this with the previous lesson, we ought to be constantly aware of when our position or talents place us in a circumstance to be of service to the Lord and do with all our might what our hands find to do. While we ought to be aware of what we do and why and do our best to anticipate his will, we don't necessarily need to have the answer to every problem or an entire plan in mind. We just need to be willing and faithful. So we want to encourage you to draw on the lessons you find most applicable here for your own walk. Remember, we all have a role, though at many points in our lives, it's not clear what that role might be. But when he has a need of us, he'll let us know. And there's no shame in being the gravy dish to be brought out at special need. We should be patient and pleased to be used in his service. Let us seek not to puff ourselves up with pride and remember that he can accomplish great victories out of the jaws of apparent defeat. And we encourage you also to listen to the recordings of Brother Hagensack and Migaz and Rice. And I'm always grateful for the Lord's leading and ask an interest in your prayers. Thank you, Brother.